This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from Master Dogen. The entire world of the Ten Directions means that all ten directions are the entire world. East, west, south, north, the four midpoints, up and down, these are the ten directions. Consider the moment when front and back, vertical and horizontal, are thoroughly reached. To consider means to understand and to resolve that this human body, undivided by self and others, is the entire world of the ten directions. This is to hear what has never been heard, because directions are all-inclusive, and all worlds are alike. The human body means the four great elements in the five skandhas. However, none of these elements and skandhas are fully understood by ordinary people. Only sages thoroughly master them. Sesshin is, for all of its bluster, is very simple, very plain, and intentionally so, necessarily so. Within a world of essentially infinite abundance, there's infinite awareness. This abundance we call the 10,000 things, phenomena. Awareness is mind. The Buddha said, have few desires. Don't seek too much from the things that you don't have. And then among those things that you have, know how to be satisfied. We could look at our zazen this way. To not seek too much. And so we create a plain, simple landscape. And then from among those things that we have, know how to use them. You have a body and a mind. You have awareness and attention. You have a heart that's beating, lungs that are breathing. You have patience, though sometimes it might be hard to find. You have faith, so sometimes it may be hard to find. And all of this so that front and back, vertical and horizontal, can be thoroughly reached. And so, within this plain landscape, what do? We sit, we walk, we eat, we sleep, we work a little, we listen, we see. And so during Sesshin, it's like, for the time being, let's live and practice as though there are not so many concerns. And maybe that's the hardest part, is to let those concerns be few, to let them rest. And to know that's not to disregard concerns, it's actually to understand that in order to learn how to regard our many concerns, there are times where we have to let them be, let them rest. I remember when I was studying music, I did a lot of practice of music every day, hours and hours and hours. And whenever there were times where I wasn't practicing, I would go on vacation, see my family, I'd be sick. And I'd come back to it after some time. And I always expected to have to sort of work my way back. But oftentimes what I found was that I felt like I'd actually moved ahead. How could that be? That I'd made progress by not playing. I remember going into a lesson one time, and before I began, I told my teacher, I said, I'm sorry, I'm really exhausted. She said, good. Maybe you won't try so hard. It was many, many years before I actually would listen to such wisdom. To live and practice as though there are not so many concerns. Can we trust that within ourselves? Because we all know that we can create a circumstance where the many concerns we have, we can't really bring with us. We have had to let them be where they are. But still, the place of our concerns can continue. And so to be unafraid of silence and stillness, of not planning, of not knowing, of not striving, to be unafraid in the midst of passing highs and lows, perceived successes and failures. The entire world of the 10 directions means that all directions are the entire world. And so as we lower our eyes and put our attention to what's right before us, really what we're doing is exactly what Dogen is saying. That by looking deeply, thoroughly reaching into one place, we discover the front, the back, the sides, the up, the down, the inside, the outside. It's like in Zazen, where in a directed practice, that one becomes everything. In an undirected practice, everything becomes one. He says, understand and resolve that this human body, undivided by self and others, is the entire world of the 10 directions. I really like that one line. To understand and resolve. To understand before we know. To resolve on the basis of faith. On the basis of a confidence which is not yet fully known to be true. And isn't that part of the magic, the power of our human consciousness, is that we can do that? And of course, that's got the potential to be dangerous when it becomes a blind kind of faith, an abdication of responsibility, an adherence to a view. That's why the Buddha said that attachment to doctrine and rules is one of the worst kind of fetters. But when it's based in a dynamic live examination, testing, that becomes extremely powerful because it means we can step forward on the basis of that faith before we know it to be true. And of course, we do that all the time. In a sense, every step we take is based on the confidence that the ground will meet our feet. We go to sleep in the confidence that we will wake up, right? Which doesn't always prove to be true. That's why it's faith. To practice and verify. To understand and resolve that this human body, undivided by self and others, it is not you, it is not apart from you. And so, because this cannot be possessed, we can't possess this body, this mind, this self, to be in alignment with that inescapable truth, we have to give up trying to possess. We have to give up our clinging. And we have to be reminded over and over and over that no matter what we want to take with us, at some point we're going to have to leave it behind. And we have to remember that this human body, while not being possessable, is also our great responsibility to practice this sacred body. While it's here, take care of it. While it's under your stewardship, take care of it. Because we can't possess anything, we'll forever be frustrated in our attempts to control. If we could possess in an alternate universe where delusion was true, consider that. If we could possess, then perhaps it would be possible to actually control things. The fact that we can't is not just our failure, it's because something about trying to control is not in alignment with how things actually work. But because this body and mind is our singular responsibility, we shouldn't ignore it. Dogen says, the human body means the four great elements and the five skandhas. However, none of these elements and skandhas are fully understood by ordinary beings. Only sages thoroughly master them. These four great elements, earth, air, fire, and water, the four offerings on every altar, the great offerings, offering earth, air, fire, and water to the Buddha is offering the whole universe. It's offering the essential stuff of everything. And since ancient times, these elements, it seems in most worlds and most cultures, have been understood as the constituent parts of our world, of everything. Everything is made up of earth, air, fire, and water. In Buddhism, also space sometimes is considered one of the elements. Sometimes consciousness is too considered one of the elements. So that everything that we see, that we touch, that we hear, is made up of these four essential elements, earth, air, fire, and water. When we sit, that's what's sitting on our cushion. When we see things arise in our mind, that's what's arising in our mind. When we reach out into our world, that's what we encounter. These four basic elements. It's everything that we relate to. We drink it in, we eat it, we discharge it, we come from it, we return to it. It's amazing, really. And to think of the miracle of earth, the miracle of air, of water, of fire, of solidity and weight, ground, of lightness, of winds, of space, of ungraspability, of heat and cool, of heart, of energy, of force, of flowing, of non-fixedness, of all that is transformational. In one of the songs of Milarepa, you know, of course, Milarepa is one of the great yogis of Tibetan Buddhism, 11th century master. And in one of his encounters, he was wandering and he came upon a village and he saw a young woman who was basically being the crew leader of a group of people who were out working the fields, and he asked her for some alms. And she pointed to a house and she said, "My grandmother." She said, "That's where I live. My grandmother's there and she'll help you." So he went down, knocked on the door, and this elderly woman opened the door and saw him, this wandering, very ragged looking hermit. And she kind of started yelling at him, you know, lazy, no good bum, living off the efforts of others. You know, why doesn't he go out and get a job like everybody else? You know, pretending to be a wise person and so on and so forth. Really was angry, really giving it to him. And he listened and he listened. And when she stopped, he basically offered her a teaching and kind of reflected back the mind that she had just presented to him. And in seeing it, sort of experiencing herself that way, she started crying because she realized how small her life had become, how unhappy she was. And right at that moment, this young woman walks in and she sees her grandmother crying. And so she says to him, "What are you doing? What did you do to my grandmother?" And she starts to lay into him, and the grandmother says, "No. No, honey, it's okay, it's okay. He's a wise sage, and he just offered me a teaching, and that's why I'm crying." And so they started to talk, and then they realized who he was, that he was the great Milarepa. And her name was Barbadam, and she was one of the four great women disciples and heirs of Milarepa. And this is their first meeting. And so she says, "Dear Lama, I have not yet made any preparations for the next life, but will now begin to do so. Please offer me the teachings on how to practice." And so he offered, he would almost always sing his teachings, and he had been singing since he was a young boy. And so he sang this teaching to her, and he said, "Listen, think of the magnitude of the sky and meditate on the vastness with no center." And so to think on the magnitude of the sky, by thinking, I don't think he means to sit there and just ruminate, but rather to take in the magnitude of the sky, to blend her mind with the sky itself. Meditate on the vastness, he says, with no center and no edge. In other words, make her mind the sky itself. Make it like space, the space element. And then he said, "Thinking of the sun and moon, meditate upon their light, where there's no darkness or obscurity." So again, not to contemplate the sun and the moon, but to make her mind, her whole body, nothing but the sun, nothing but the moon. One of the early practices that the Buddha taught is to meditate on various objects. We use the breath. But there are other objects that were taught that could be meditated on. And there are various forms of orbs or discs, right? A perfect form, the circle, that initially is put outside of yourself as you meditate on it and develop your concentration, just like you would with the breath. But then at some point, you bring that into your mind. You're not relying on a visual object outside of yourself, but now it becomes your mind itself. And ultimately, as he says, to think on this in such a way that your whole being becomes nothing but this orb, this sun, this moon, where there's no darkness or obscurity, like the fire element, to make your whole body and mind light. Then he says, "Resembling the unchanging solid mountain before you, you should meditate with steadiness and stability." And so here, to make your whole body and mind a mountain, right? It's firmly rooted in the ground, but reaches up, fills the sky. Steady and solid, right? Completely stable. Don't Dogen says to study the way with the body means to study with your own body using this lump of red flesh. And so here the mountain becomes your lump of red flesh. Then he says, like the ocean, infinitely great and unfathomably deep, absorb yourself in deepest contemplation, thus meditate on your self-mind, on your original mind. Infinitely great, unfathomably deep. Make your whole being the ocean. Now you think about, since the beginning of time, of human experience, that we have encountered our ancestors, and we today encounter these four essential elements, these four modes of being, these four minds, sky, that's vast, without boundary, water, which reaches out in all directions, and that even when there are waves and turbulence on the top, that down below, it's completely still and quiet. Fire, having the power to destroy, but also having the power to bring forth all that is good. And the earth, right? The ground of being, that which we walk upon, that which we are. And so you think about this relationship with these essential elements, these earth mind, sky mind, right? And that for as long as we've been human beings, we've been living with, amidst, digesting, releasing, relating to, working with, being awed by, being scared by, terrified by, worshiping these elements. And so what kind of depth, what kind of deep knowing is there in our body with regards to these elements? Why is it that when we sit, this is the form that we take? Very much like a mountain, a broad base. Coming forward, up to a point. Touching the ground, reaching up into the sky, steady. Is it that we are following the example of the mountain? Or is it that we are that mountain itself? That is, we work with the fire within us, right, that burns hot and destroys, but then becomes familiar. Right? Not domesticated, because by its nature it's wild, but able to work with that fire. So it doesn't just run out of control and burn the field down, but actually it begins to bring forth life. Kind of interesting to think about. And then Milarepa ends by saying, thus, with no doubt and error, practice. Without having any doubt or error, practice. It's like Dogen saying, understand and resolve that this human body, undivided, is the whole world. In other words, with faith and deep trust, and by aligning yourself with the Dharma, now practice. Now, obviously, these elements, we can speak of them as different, having different qualities, taking different forms, but we also know at the same time that they're not divisible. That they're interdependent, that they all make up one body, one world. And so to allow the mind to be that vast, with no center or edge, to be without obscurity or darkness, to be steady and unwavering, to be deep and unfathomable, Isn't this exactly what we're doing in Zazen? And in a way that isn't just trying to, you know, contrive a state, but actually by letting go of all of our contrived states, created states, experiencing naturally those basic elements. And so we practice as one unified, intelligent whole. That's the way Milarepa is instructing Barbadham to practice, us to practice. And this is why the judging mind, the measuring mind, the comparing mind, the critical mind, which divides and separates and creates opposition, why the past mind and the future mind create divisions of past, present, and future, of longing and anxiety, why the distracted mind that numbs and exhausts, why all of these are so important to practice, not just because they create distractedness and they create suffering for ourselves and they don't allow us to settle our minds, but perhaps in a much, much deeper way, because they render that which is whole as divided. They take that which is sacred, these essential elements, our constituent parts that are ancient, both spiritually and also physically, right? Nothing new has been created, right? That's the law. We're all just constantly reusing, repurposing, recycling. And so this mountain of form, all of the parts of this have been here since the beginning. How resilient. It's like, you know, our deluded mind is like taking this vast, spacious, free, self-intelligent, wondrous being and all of the qualities of this and trying to stuff it into a little box, trap it, control it. And that's why delusion is always experienced as confining, right? That's why these various states of mind that we find ourselves in are always make us feel like we're being trapped. And so in that way, when we think of having spent our whole lives within that, this kind of divided, confined, limited sense of self and body and world, all aimed at trying to, in a sense, tame or domesticate, right? Take all of the magic, all the mystery out, you know, and so we have to go to the movies to get it back, right? And don't quite get it back. It's why our poets, our artists, and our mystics are constantly, those who are really speaking from that place, are constantly trying to speak on behalf of, remind us of, bring us back to this part of ourself which is not linear, which will not be contained, cannot be domesticated, but is not chaotic or confused. And so then when we struggle You know, so you might think, well, why then, when we practice, why don't we just, rather than sitting here in stillness, why don't we go out in the field and just run crazy, right? Because that's what we're already doing, right? We've just domesticated that sufficiently so that we can, like, keep our cool and present our cool, sort of keep it in. And so we, kind of maybe surprisingly, if we think about it this way, you know, turn towards that release by going to this place, this very, very simple, plain place, this cushion. You know, very little equipment, right? You don't need much. And that as we enter into those elements, into this body and mind, and then we encounter all of that, the efforts of that confinement, and we experience up close the actual experience of that confinement, which in our ordinary life, you know, we work very hard and, you know, are reasonably good at keeping all, you know, one step ahead, you know, with serious failures along the way, fortunately, that bring us up to what's actually going on, that it's uncomfortable as hell, right? That's why practice is so uncomfortable. It's not just that our bodies aren't used to sitting. It's not just that we're, you know, distracted. I mean, so what's the big deal? So we've spent our whole lives distracted. We sit on the cushion and suddenly distraction is uncomfortable? I mean, we should feel like we're right at home. So what the hell's going on? Maybe all of that discomfort and the anxiety and the straining and the struggle are the signs of those gaps beginning to close, right? Of those divisions beginning to dissolve. Of that turning away, beginning to turn towards, of that rejection beginning to accept. And we would think that because all of those are signs of what is good and true, that the experience of it would automatically and immediately and necessarily be good and true. And that's not what we experience in the beginning. And that's not because it's not good and true, it's just because the depth of that creates that degree of discomfort. The strength of our discomfort is the strength of our clinging. The amount of time it takes to release is the amount of time it's taken, probably times a million, to develop those states. But if we think of that rather than being a sign, because we impute meaning into it, rather than being a sign that something's wrong, I'm no good at this, this shouldn't be happening, where's my equanimity? Right? Why isn't my mind settled? All of that stuff, this measuring mind that thinks it's right and knows what it's talking about. Rather, if we could begin to shift our experience, our association with those experiences, rather than being signs of danger or just wrongness, and actually begin to experience it as a sign of shifting into, of thoroughly reaching. You know, we know this in other ways. You know, when you're doing something for the first time, stretching or, you know, running or doing anything particularly physical, you know, and it aches. But if you have, you know, some relationship with your body and movement, then you know that's a good ache, right? You know the difference between a good ache and a not good ache. It's like, this is the sign that I'm developing new muscles, that I'm gaining strength, that this is the path to facility, right? to practicing without doubt and error. And so then when we experience it that way, we don't see it as a cause for alarm, but rather for encouragement. But it's very difficult for that to happen in practice, right? Because so much of it appears as thoughts, and the thoughts are communicating something, and we think it's true. Or it's emotional, and emotions always speak a kind of truth. Or just because we're not, simply because we're not accustomed to it. It's just new terrain. Constantly. Barbadam came back to Milarepa after having practiced for quite a while and said, "It was fine when I contemplated on the sky, but I felt uneasy when I encountered clouds. It was good when I meditated on the sun and moon, but I felt anxious when I saw stars and planets. It was good when I contemplated the solid mountain, but I didn't know what to do in the presence of trees and bushes. It was good when I contemplated the great ocean, but I felt uneasy in the presence of waves." So true. We let go into open space and then we're startled when something new appears. We let go of two, but then are frightened by three. We meet the mind, but then we freak out with the body. We break free of the past, but then we don't know what to do with today. And in a sense, what I hear in her words are not yet thoroughly reached. Reaching, moving, but not yet thoroughly reached. And so contemplating the sky and being disturbed by clouds means not yet sky mind, but moving towards. And to appreciate that every moment, in any way, in any direction, using whatever you have, that is helping to close that distance, to dissolve that division, to make true that false view, even just a little bit, to turn back rather than away, to turn in rather than away. Is moving into thoroughly reaching. Longchenpa, a very important Tibetan master of the 14th century, said, "Constantly deconstructing, investigating keenly, not even the slightest substance can be found. And in this moment of undivided, non-dual perception, we abide in the natural state of perfection." And to deconstruct, in a sense, really means just don't construct, to cease from constructing, to not create anything false. Dogen says, now, enter the 10 directions within one particle of dust. Right? Having made your whole mind and body, earth, air, fire, and water, space, now you can enter into one particle of dust and see the 10 directions. You're no longer confined one particle of dust to be just a particle of dust. Now, from that place, construct a training hall. Construct a Buddha hall within that single particle of dust. Construct a practice. Construct a world where people matter. Construct a vow to realize Buddha nature. Bring forth an intention to practice this day. In this way, the human body is constructed, and such construction, all construction, comes from this human body. This is the meaning of the entire world of the Ten Directions, is the true human body. And so in all of Buddhist practice, working with objects, working with mandalas, and entering into those worlds, in front of you, in your mind, entering into koans, a shit stick, a cypress tree, a phrase, a word, entering into your breath, entering into clear awareness. All of these forms of practice are this. Enter the 10 directions within one particle of dust. Now, within that, construct a training hall. Construct a life. Longchenpa also said, in the universal womb that is boundless space, all forms of matter and energy occur as flux of the four elements. There is nothing but that. And all of this are nothing but empty forms absent in reality. All phenomena that arise in pure mind are like this. And so when we get so stuck in the intractability, the fixedness, the entrenched, the strength of the habit, the thing that won't budge, that won't move. What's not moving in that moment is not the thing, but mind. The mind that is water appears to be dammed. The mind that is air seems to be not flowing. And so practice is just to continually step forward, shift. Be like the early spring maple, so many years receiving the gifts of sun and rain, soil and breeze. My roots run all the way down. My branches caress the clouds. Without taking a step, I'm already home. Or an alternate ending. My roots run all the way down, my branches caress the clouds. This lump of wood and bark. What? What? We think we're so modern, you know. And we are. We're modern because we're living today. But to think about the ancientness of what we're doing, the ancientness of this. I find a great comfort and a sense of trust in that. Right. I never was interested in something that somebody had just made up today. Because I thought, how can I trust that? How can I know? Because I don't know. How can I know? And to think about the ancientness of this. So simple. So vast.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.